Chapter 11. At last, one morning, in a clear spot of a glassy horizon charged with heraldic masses of black vapors, the island grew out from the sea, showing here and there its naked members of basaltic rock through the rents of heavy foliage. Later, in the great spilling of all the riches of sunset, Malata stood out green and rosy before turning into a violet shadow in the autumnal light of the expiring day. Then came the night. In the faint airs the schooner crept on past a sturdy squat headland, and it was pitch dark. When her headsails ran down, she turned short on her heel, and her anchor bit into the sandy bottom on the edge of the outer reef. For it was too dangerous then to attempt entering the little bay full of shoals. After the last solemn flutter of the mainsail, the murmuring voices of the Moorsome party lingered, very frail, in the black stillness. They were sitting aft, on chairs, and nobody made a move. Early in the day, when it had become evident that the wind was failing, Renouard, basing his advice on the shortcomings of his bachelor establishment, had urged on the ladies the advisability of not going ashore in the middle of the night. Now he approached them in a constrained manner. It was astonishing the constraint that had reigned between him and his guests all through the passage, and renewed his arguments. No one ashore would dream of his bringing any visitors with him. Nobody would even think of coming off. There was only one old canoe on the plantation, and landing in the schooner's boats would be awkward in the dark. There was the risk of getting aground on some shallow patches. It would be best to spend the rest of the night on board. There was really no opposition. The professor, smoking a pipe, and very comfortable in an ulster buttoned over his tropical clothes, was the first to speak from his long chair. "Most excellent advice." Next to him, Miss Moorsome assented by a long silence. Then in a voice, as of one coming out of a dream, "And so this is Malata," she said. "Have often wondered." A shiver passed through Renouard. As he had wondered. What about? Malata was himself. He and Malata were one. And as he had wondered. As he had. The professor's sister leaned over towards Renouard. Through all these days at sea, the man's, the found man's existence had not been alluded to on board the schooner. That reticence was part of the general constraint lying upon them all. She, herself, certainly had not been exactly elated by this finding poor Arthur, without money, without prospects. But she felt moved by the sentiment and romance of the situation. "Isn't it wonderful," she whispered out of her white wrap, "to think of poor Arthur sleeping there, so near to our dear lovely Felicia, and not knowing the immense joy in store for him tomorrow?" There was such artificiality in the wax flower lady that nothing in this speech touched Renouard. It was but the simple anxiety of his heart that he was voicing when he muttered gloomily, "No one in the world knows what tomorrow may hold in store." The mature lady had a recoil, as though he had said something impolite. What a harsh thing to say instead of finding something nice and appropriate. On board, where she never saw him in evening clothes, Renouard's resemblance to a duke's son was not so apparent to her. Nothing but his abohemianism remained. She rose with a sort of ostentation. "It's late, and since we are going to sleep on board tonight," she said. "But it does seem so cruel." The professor started up eagerly, knocking the ashes out of his pipe. "Infinitely more sensible, my dear Emma." Renouard waited behind Miss Moorsome's chair. She got up slowly, moved one step forward, and paused looking at the shore. The blackness of the island blotted out the stars with its vague mass like a low thundercloud brooding over the waters, and ready to burst into flame and crashes. "And so this is Malata," she repeated dreamily, moving towards the cabin door. The clear cloak hanging from her shoulders, the ivory face for the night had put out nothing of her, but the gleams of her hair made her resemble a shining dream woman uttering words of wistful inquiry. She disappeared without a sign, leaving Renouard penetrated to the very marrow by the sounds that came from her body like a mysterious resonance of an exquisite instrument. He stood stock still. What was this accidental touch which had evoked the strange accent of her voice? He dared not answer that question. But he had to answer the question of what was to be done now. Had the moment of confession come? The thought was enough to make one's blood run cold. It was as if those people had a premonition of something. In the taciturn days of the passage, he had noticed their reserve even amongst themselves. The professor smoked his pipe moodily in retired spots. Renauer had caught Miss Morsom's eyes resting on himself more than once, with a peculiar and grave expression. He fancied that she avoided all opportunities of conversation. The maiden lady seemed to nurse a grievance. And now what had he to do? The lights on the deck had gone out one after the other. The schooner slept. About an hour after Miss Morsom had gone below without a sign or a word for him, Renauer got out of his hammock slung in the waist under the midship awning, for he had given up all the accommodation below to his guests. He got out with a sudden swift movement, flung off his sleeping jacket, rolled his pajamas up his thighs, and stole forward, unseen by the one Kanaka of the anchor watch. His white torso, naked like a stripped athlete's, glimmered, ghostly, in the deep shadows of the deck. Unnoticed, he got out of the ship over the night heads, ran along the back rope, and seizing the dolphin striker firmly with both hands, lowered himself into the sea without a splash. He swam away, noiseless like a fish, and then struck boldly for the land, sustained, embraced, by the tepid water. The gentle, voluptuous heave of its breast swung him up and down slightly. Sometimes a wavelet murmured in his ears. From time to time, lowering his feet, he felt for the bottom on a shallow patch, to rest and correct his direction. He landed at the lower end of the bungalow garden, into the dead stillness of the island. There were no lights. The plantation seemed to sleep, as profoundly as the schooner. On the path a small shell cracked under his naked heel. The faithful half-caste foreman going his rounds cocked his ears at the sharp sound. He gave one enormous start of fear at the sight of the swift white figure flying at him out of the night. He crouched in terror, and then sprang up, and clicked his tongue in amazed recognition. See! See! The master! Be quiet, Luz, and listen to what I say. Yes, it was the master, the strong master who was never known to raise his voice, the man blindly obeyed and never questioned. He talked low and rapidly in the quiet night, as if every minute were precious. On learning that three guests were coming to stay, Luz clicked his tongue rapidly. These clicks were the uniform, stenographic symbols of his emotions, and he could give them an infinite variety of meaning. He listened to the rest in a deep silence hardly affected by the low, yes, master, whenever Renauer paused. You understand? The latter insisted. Oh, preparations are to be made till we land in the morning. And you are to say that Mr. Walter has gone off in a trading schooner on a round of the islands. Yes, master. No mistakes, mind. No, master. Renauer walked back towards the sea. Luz, following him, proposed to call out half a dozen boys and man the canoe. Imbecile. See. 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 Don't you understand that you haven't seen me? Yes, master. But what a long swim. Suppose you drown. Then you can say of me and of Mr. Walter what you like. The dead don't mind. Renauer entered the sea and heard a faint see. 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 Of concern from the half-caste, who had already lost sight of the master's dark head on the overshadowed water. Renauer set his direction by a big star that, dipping on the horizon, seemed to look curiously into his face. On this swim back he felt the mournful fatigue of all that length of the traversed road, which brought him no nearer to his desire. It was as if his love had sapped the invisible supports of his strength. There came a moment when it seemed to him that he must have swum beyond the confines of life. He had a sensation of eternity close at hand, demanding no effort, offering its peace. It was easy to swim like this beyond the confines of life looking at a star. But the thought, "Hey, will think I dared not face them and committed suicide," caused a revolt of his mind which carried him on. He returned on board, as he had left, unheard and unseen. He lay in his hammock utterly exhausted, and with a confused feeling that he had been beyond the confines of life, somewhere near a star, and that it was very quiet there. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.